Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like to welcome to the program John Tierman. He is Principal Research Scientist and Executive Director of the Center for International Studies at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His new book is The Deaths of Others, The Fate of Civilians in America's Wars. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you study America's wars from the colonial period through the present. Talk about the mentality behind the violence against American Indians. This was thought of at that time as a quote-unquote necessity. Why was that?
Well, the Puritans who came to my part of the continent in the early 17th century, of course, they came with a mission. It was a Christian mission. It was a mission of God, in their view, and the challenge for them, among others, was to tame the wilderness. To them, this was all wilderness, and, of course, in the wilderness were the savages, to use their word, which was, of course, the indigenous tribes of North America. And what ensued rather soon, not right away, but in the first few decades of this European settlement here, what ensued was a series of rather nasty encounters, including a fairly sizable war, which is called King Philip's War, which has nothing to do with anyone named King Philip. It was a name that was given to the leader of the Wampanoag Indians. But what ensued was not only these violent encounters, but an ideology that formed about the errand into the wilderness, that this was the mission of this religious community to tame the wilderness, to gather its bounty, to essentially eliminate the heathen savages. And this, you know, this formed the consciousness of Americans, what came to be known as Americans, the European settlers, over the next couple of hundred years, and then also informed our westward expansion, the frontier myth, all the way to the Pacific. And it is a very resilient set of ideas and associated behaviors.
I think it's important to discuss the reality that these people who were taming the so-called savages were themselves horrifyingly savage in the way they killed. And, I mean, there is a historical, there's also, as you write, a psychological dimension to all of this. It's kind of like it's a projection of our own savagery onto others. And yet as Americans, we can't seem to grasp this or even see ourselves clearly, at least on a large scale.
Oh, yeah. The savagery of the Puritans, you know, we think of the Puritans as being kind of the upright, kind of uptight religious types here in their black hats and whatnot. But they fought ferociously against many native tribes. There are stories not only around King Philip's War, but others at the time. They obliterated the Pequot Indians. They often sold them into slavery, those that survived. They burned down villages with children in their huts. And, you know, I mean, very, very brutal stuff, and all justified in the name of God. And, you know, this was a very formative moment for America, not only because they were among the first Europeans here and the first really permanent settlement of Europeans here, but they wrote about it greatly. And so there were novels, there were diaries, there were sermons, other kinds of instructive material that then began to, you know, shape the consciousness of the Americans, colonial America and post-colonial America. So it's a very important period in how we shape our national narrative, what our national narrative is, you know, this restless expansion of the frontier, the, you know, the democratic values of the frontier, the rugged individualism, and so on. All with a religion and a religious mission as a backdrop to this. But there was no question, it was savage war, it was wars of annihilation, something like 85% of all the indigenous tribes on this continent were obliterated by the end of the 19th century. I mean, that's a Holocaust, really.
It's also, I think, quite disturbing that this notion of the American project, as you say, this great American sense of freedom, Jeffersonian democracy, and so on, was inextricably tied up with the necessity of killing so many people. And, I mean, these are ideals that, to this day, many nice American peace-loving people embrace.
Well, that's true. And I think that one of the signal contributions of the frontier myth and writing about the frontier myth is Richard Slotkin has, who's one of the people I quote somewhat extensively. One of his contributions was to describe how violence became such an important part of this. And again, we don't often think about it in this way, but the fact is that violence was not only instrumental, that is, in the view of the European American settlers moving out across the continent, was necessary, an instrument of expansion, but it was actually thought of as redemptive or even regenerative of the moral spirit of the settlers, so that the killing of Native Americans and others, Mexicans in the Mexican War and so on, became a kind of, I don't want to call it a spiritual journey exactly, but it definitely has a kind of a moral patina to it that one wouldn't normally associate with war. And these kinds of expansionist, really imperialist wars that we conducted right up to the end of the 19th century, not really so long ago.
How did they justify Christianity, one of whose main tenets is peace and not killing anybody? I mean, help us understand this kind of moral and spiritual justification of slicing open pregnant women and killing children and all those kinds of horrible things they did.
Well, that's a good question, and I'm not sure I'm equipped to answer it. But I think that the history of Christianity has been a history that has been replete with war, not only here on this continent, but, of course, in Europe, in the Middle East, and elsewhere. When you think about what the Crusades were, for example, I have a little footnote in my book about the First Crusade, because the way that we view Muslims in this country, even today, is informed by how Europeans confronted the expansion of Islam going back 1,000 years. So in 1095, the Pope Urban II, declared the First Crusade. He didn't call it the First Crusade because he didn't know there were going to be others, but a crusade to recapture Jerusalem. And it was actually, in terms of, if you read his declaration, it reads like what we would now associate with a declaration of jihad. It's a holy war, and it's meant to be violent, and it's meant to annihilate the enemy, and it's meant to kill people who are not Christians. So there has been this streak of violence in organized religion. Not that all Christians are like this, of course, but there's been this streak that goes back a very long way. And of course, there were horrendously bloody wars in Europe for 1,000 years among Christians, between Christians. So for them to do this to the natives in this continent and then moving out across the world in the 20th century shouldn't come as a surprise. Why it happens is a theological question that I'm not sure I can answer.
Well, there's the theological aspect of it, and I think probably a deep psychological aspect of it. But then there's also, I mean, you wrote in your book that a lot of the Indians who were most savagely brutalized were the ones who had the most mineral resources under their land.
Well, there is no question that part of the ideology, starting with the Puritans on this continent, was the bounty of the wilderness was there for the taking. So one's errand, as they call it, the errand into the wilderness was not only about taming the savages and, you know, cutting down the trees and cultivating the land and so on. It was about the bounty of the wilderness, which, of course, could come in very many different forms of material bounty, which included things like mineral rights eventually and timber and water and fertile land and so on. So, yes, it comes in many forms, and it still is the ideology that that motivates a lot of our ventures abroad. So it's a very important piece of American history.
We're talking to John Tierman about his book, The Deaths of Others, The Fate of Civilians in America's Wars. Once the American frontier reached its limits, the entire rest of the world became essentially our frontier. What did the beginnings of U.S. imperial policy look like?
Well, there was a big debate at the end of the 19th century in American politics. It was a very visible debate that had to do with the end of the frontier. In part, the Census Bureau, of all things, declared the end of the frontier. The frontier was closed in 1891. No more land to open up. And so this occasioned a little bit of an intellectual crisis, because the frontier, as I said earlier, was always associated with the democratic values that we hold dear as part of our national ideology. And so what do you do when the frontier closes? Well, you look abroad for new frontiers, right? And politicians like Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, among others, were at the forefront of sorting this out, and it first had its first real world manifestation, if you will, in the Spanish-American War in Cuba, our taking of Puerto Rico, but most importantly, our taking of the Philippines. And the Philippines was particularly important for two reasons in this story. One is because the real imaginary of this frontier, of this American mindset, was China. And the Philippines was viewed as a stepping stone to China. Even, you know, this is going back 12 years ago. The Philippines was also important because there was an independence movement in the Philippines, an indigenous movement, first breaking out against the Spanish colonialists, and then, as America took power in the Philippines, against the American army. And it was a very nasty little war. We don't learn much about this war in our schools. It's not really taught the way the other wars are. And yet it was a precursor, really, to wars that we fought much more recently in places like Vietnam, in which you had a genuine independence movement, reasonably well-armed and well-educated group of people leading it, and a lot of peasants who were fighting for their rights against the imperial power. And this is where the American imperium really began, perhaps more than anywhere else outside our own continent.
That was a pretty brutal chapter in our history. Can you describe a little bit of what actually happened in the Philippines so we can get a picture of what it looked like on the ground?
Yeah, it was a brutal war. It was a brutal war for a couple of reasons. One is that it was a well-armed resistance group, an independence group led by a man named Aguinaldo. And he was a charismatic leader. As I say, this independence movement existed for several years before the United States took possession of the Philippines. And they had thought, Aguinaldo and his people thought for a short time that the United States may actually be liberators, right, against the old Spanish crown, monarchy. And this did not turn out to be the case. We sent a very large contingent of forces there. Something like 200,000 people at least died in the Philippines during the worst part of the war, which was in the 1898 to about 1903. But the war actually continued in several of the different islands in the archipelago of the Philippines for several years after that. So sort of resembles Iraq in that sense, or Afghanistan. It goes on for a long period of time. A lot of people died of disease. A lot of American soldiers died of disease. But it was a war in which the United States military committed some very serious atrocities. I mean, it was even acknowledged by some of the military officers at the time. against the Philippines people. And, you know, there was no question about the fact who were the imperialists and who were the, you know, the people fighting for their own sovereignty. No ambiguity there. And, it was not something that people wanted to remember. Mark Twain wrote very famously about the Philippines, some very sardonic pieces in which he criticized the U.S. behavior there. So it was not something that was completely missed in the United States, but basically it was viewed as sort of a great triumph of the new, you know, world power of the United States. And Roosevelt in particular, who is lionized to this day in this country, much to my amazement, was very proud of the fact that he basically obliterated this independence movement and saw this indeed as a stepping stone into the rest of Asia.
In many or perhaps most or maybe all U.S. wars, excepting the Civil War, the number of people killed that are foreigners versus Americans, it's much higher. In other words, in the Vietnam War, 99% of the people who were killed were Vietnamese. In the war in the Philippines, it was also a very high number. To what extent was that kind of killing, both the horror and the scale of it, understood by the American public, and to what extent did they care?
Well, in the Philippines, I think that one has to remember that the way that wars were covered at that time by the news media, which was basically newspapers and magazines, was very different in the sense that the press, the penny press, the yellow journal, and this was the height of sensationalistic journalism, although I think we're probably in another period like that now. They were very jingoistic. They were very much in favor of the excursion into the Philippines. It was portrayed in the news media as a triumph of American, this new American globalism and muscle. So there wasn't much criticism. There wasn't much information to go on for the average American reader, even those who were literate and paid attention to these things. So it was a very different environment than the environment we see after, say, World War II, where you have a much different kind of news media, much broader, much better, actually, in most respects, and a much more literate and interested public. But there were people who were opposed to the war. There was an opposition, as my friend Howard Zinn wrote about in The People's History. There were dissidents against the whole notion of America becoming an imperial power, although it was slightly a mixed bag, because in some cases the anti-imperialists, like William Jennings Bryan, were anti-imperialists because they didn't want to have large influxes of brown-skinned people coming into the United States. I mean, it was very much a mixed message coming from the anti-imperialists. But in any case, there was a debate. But the concern for the Filipinos per se, I think, was not particularly great.
We're talking to John Tierman about his book, The Deaths of Others, The Fate of Civilians in America's Wars. One of the things that your book has made me think about is the American ideal of self-sufficiency. I mean, once the frontier was closed and the Jeffersonian ideal of the small farmer gave way to this massive industrial buildup, it becomes so clear, if it wasn't already, that we as Americans have never been able to survive without taking other people's stuff.
Well, that's certainly one way of looking at it, which is a perfectly valid way. I think that the expansionist tendencies of the United States are similar to the expansionist tendencies of other big powers that are able to do that, that have the means, have the military power, have the transportation, have the capital, have the corporations, have the ways of global reach that make imperialism both very attractive and feasible. So it is a it's certainly true that the United States has been paramount in this, particularly in the post-World War II era, but one thinks back at earlier times in the 20th century, the French in Africa and Asia, the British all over the world, the Soviet Union and the Russians before them in their neck of the woods expanding out. This is, I don't want to call it a natural tendency because I would hope that it's not, in fact, natural, but it does happen under certain circumstances. The United States has been very clever about how they do this. And this is one important piece that I do write about, and that is that U.S. imperialism has generally not been about taking land. I mean, the Philippines, in some ways, was an anomaly in that respect. Most of the time, what one might be considered American imperialism or hegemony is about control. It's about control of countries. It's about control of economic systems and resources. It's about control of ideologies. It's not about actual land possession, but it has the same effect with respect to what you were talking about, which is basically the acquisitiveness of the American public and how we've had to go out and get resources, get oil, get minerals, get labor, and so on to keep the engine here running hot.
In order to do that kind of imperialism, you have to have narratives to sell that to the American public so that they're really behind it. What are some of the narratives historically that have been used for that purpose?
Well, that's a very good point, and I think narratives, national narratives, are little understood, really, for what they are, because we tend to just accept them in one way or another. The national narrative for the United States is a complex one. It's now a 400-year-old country, if you count from the time that the European settlers came, and that narrative mainly is, I believe, the frontier myth, which is that this is what sets us apart from others, particularly European countries. It is a set of morals and ideas that have to do with, you know, the self-sufficiency and you know, the democratic virtue of the frontier, where, you know, everybody is their own master and so on. And, you know, the application of that to the rest of the world became, I think, almost rote. I mean, it became very, very natural for presidents like John F. Kennedy to talk about the new frontier, for example, or Wilson before him, or Franklin Roosevelt before him, in different ways, but using essentially the same mythology. We are the ones who are going to bring civilization to the rest of the world. We push out the frontiers of civilization to the, you know, underdeveloped world, the third world, what have you, and we bring the blessings of this civilization, of democracy and capitalism and Christianity, to these nether regions of the world. And this is we are beneficent. We are helping the rest of the world by doing this. Occasionally, we meet resistance. The resistance has to be very quickly dealt with, usually by violent means. So we have, you know, a war in Korea. We have a war in Vietnam. We have containment of the Soviet Union. We have lots of skirmishes in Latin America in the 1950s and 60s and Africa and so on. And these are all basically justified in these terms. I mean, you could call it other things. You could call it manifest destiny, which is a term associated with the Mexican, you know, Mexican-American War. You can call it American exceptionalism. I mean, there are lots of ways that it's been framed. I think the frontier myth is the most complete explanation, and it roots it in the Puritan experience, and it goes right up to the present day. Look at Iraq. Why did we get into Iraq? Well, it's partly about Saddam Hussein and the phony WMDs, but it was also about taming this savage frontier, right? It was about this is the last frontier in the world that has not bent to America's will, the Arab Middle East. We're going to extend the blessings of civilization into Iraq. We're going to take the bounty of the oil, and everything's going to be just fine. And in fact, the war in Iraq and the 2003 war in Iraq was justified in just these kinds of terms, sometimes post hoc, often and with cowboys and Indians kind of imagery. And, you know, so we use this ideology right to the present day, no matter how futile it very often is.
I don't know if you can speak to this, but I was thinking about the frontier mentality and that there's always new frontiers to open. And basically at this point, we're at a stage of really being on the verge of destroying many, many of the species on our planet. And so not only is there new wilderness, but we're destroying the wilderness that we actually need to sustain ourselves and to sustain basic life functions in the ecosystems on our planet. And as that understanding is taking hold, is there anything happening to the frontier myth? I mean, it's just so worn out at this point and so wrong in terms of the reality of life on Earth.
Well, I'm glad you raised that, Mary Charlotte, because I had an essay in the American Scholar, which is a quarterly journal, in December of 2008, just as Obama was about to be inaugurated, and it argued exactly the point that you've just raised, which, because I'd gotten interested in the frontier, I was writing this book at that time, but I sort of got fascinated by this very question. It's just sort of the end of the frontier in, you know, the 1890s led us in a way to expand out into the rest of the world. What happens if you believe the global frontier is now closing also, which I think it manifestly is, just as you described, mainly because of ecological limits, but also the limits of military power, which we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, what happens then? What kind of frontier should we try to conquer, or should we completely abandon the frontier myth? I think it's a very important question, and it's the kind of question we don't ask very often, because it makes people queasy to think that we've been operating on, you know, sort of false premises for so long, and now we can't even stand on those false premises. I don't know the answer to it. I mean, I would love to see a national debate about, you know, using the frontier myth perhaps to apply to our public schools, or to, you know, saving the planet's ecology, or finding ways to have a robust, equitable economy without destroying the environment, and so on. I mean, that was part, actually, of what Kennedy was talking about 50 years ago in his acceptance speech in Los Angeles. The new frontier was not meant, in fact, to be just about expansion in the old sense, but about thinking about new ways of thinking, about thinking of frontiersmanship, if that's the right word, in terms of helping our own society and other societies do better. But there is also an imperialistic kind of content to that, so we need to rethink that very carefully.
And if I may say so, I mean, maybe it's time to abandon the frontier way of thinking altogether and look at countries and cultures that don't have a frontier mentality and see how they survive perhaps more peacefully than we ever have.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think that the case can certainly be made that the frontier myth is exhausted and needs to be shelved for good.
We're talking to John Tierman about his book, The Deaths of Others, The Fate of Civilians in America's Wars. Now, the United States has often been said to have a violent culture, and yet the brutality of soldiers is not generally discussed at all when we talk about this. I mean, we talk about inner city violence or gun violence and so on, and yet soldiers totally get a pass. What's going on?
Well, I think that there's an interesting phenomenon in which soldiers have become more and more lionized, have become heroes. You know, we constantly refer to many people in the American society and culture have tended to hold up soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan as heroes, no matter what they're doing there, you know, and have debased, I think, the whole notion of heroism, but also have, by doing so, have tried, I think, to blunt criticism of the war or criticism of the behavior of some soldiers who are acting badly. And so I think we need to resist or at least examine this notion that every soldier is a hero or every police officer is a hero or every, you know, Marine or firefighter or whatever. This comes out of 9/11, I think, more than anything else. But also it comes out of a misperception about Vietnam and how Vietnam veterans were treated by war resistors or opponents of the war in Vietnam. There's a sort of persistent myth that soldiers were really badly mistreated when they came back from Vietnam. I think they were probably mistreated, but they were mistreated by the Veterans Administration and the people who started the war more than they were people who opposed the war. But in any case, I think that sort of mentality has carried into the present day, and in the sense that now we have to treat everybody with kid gloves. We need to evaluate what the military is doing generally, just as vigorously as we should examine what the government is doing in any other sphere, in terms of waste and false ideologies and self-interestedness and so on. It's the largest bureaucracy in the world and has been for quite a long time, and it exhibits a lot of bureaucratic behavior that is not in anybody's interests. So, you know, we need to take a fresh, honest look at the military. And it's interesting in this debt ceiling debate how the military has been, you know, sort of used as a lever to change the political discourse about debt and taxes and so on. It's still off limits in some ways. It's still off limits to talk about defense spending and you know, military ventures. Now we're in not only Libya, but we're in Somalia, we're in Yemen, we're in, you know, all these places without any public debate about it and without any accountability for, you know, behavior of the drone strikes and all the rest of it. I mean, it's really more out of control now than at any time in my memory.
So the military gets a pass, soldiers get a pass, and then it still remains that when you talk to soldiers individually, and I have a friend who was in Iraq, I know a number of people who come home and they say, "Don't you dare call me a hero." What they see and what they experience so often shatters them, and they don't feel like heroes at all if you get them speaking honestly.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't, in my book, I do not blame individual soldiers, except where there's clear culpability and, you know, the case of a few atrocities. But for the most part, it's not the soldiers' fault when civilians are killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, it is their fault in the sense that they may be pulling the trigger or launching the bomb. But they're usually ordered to do these things by officers, or they're trained to do them under certain circumstances. And, of course, it's the political leaders who've gotten us into those wars that are ultimately responsible. The individual soldiers, I agree with you. I was on a radio program the other day where there were call-ins, and there were two calls in the Baltimore area from veterans of the Iraq War, and they were, it's very interesting that they basically agreed with my analysis. I was being very critical of the military in Iraq, as I am in my book, and their reaction was they saw a lot of bad things. I don't blame these soldiers. I mean, I think it's a great tragedy that the young men, very often mostly men, who are don't have many other opportunities in life, at least at that point, go into the military and then serve two or three tours of duty in these awful wars. They can't tell civilians from fighters. They don't speak the language. They're in these ridiculously hot, you know, environments and suits that are not made. This is just a horrendous experience for these people, and it's going to affect them the rest of their life. And I have nothing but sympathy for them.
Let's go back to the early 20th century, early to mid-20th century. As you write, in World War I, there were 9 times as many soldiers killed as civilians, and in World War II, there were 9 times as many civilians killed as soldiers. Why this change? What did the civilian deaths in World War II look like?
Yeah, I'm not sure those ratios. Those are bandied about as kind of an example of how the ratio has changed. I don't think they're necessarily absolutely accurate ratios. But the point is that there are many more civilians now killed in wars than there were 100 years ago, and that's because you had clear lines of fighters were in uniform and there were lines of battle and so on and so forth, so you knew who were fighters and who were civilians. In World War II, it began to change a little bit. You still had fighters in uniforms, but you had the strategic bombing that occurred in Germany and Japan by the Allied powers that was intentionally meant to kill civilians, intentionally meant to demoralize, as they put it, the civilian population and the society as a whole, and try to stop the war that way. In Japan, for example, before Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there were firebombs using napalm of 60 cities in Japan, including Tokyo, which, of course, burned for days. 180,000 people at least were killed in the firebombing of Tokyo. People going, evacuating the countryside, mass starvation, very, very ugly. The Japanese civilians, obviously, not responsible for the war. In fact, Hiroshima was chosen for the atomic bomb in part because it had not, one of the few major cities that had not been firebombed. So, there were a lot of civilians that were killed that way, a lot of civilians who were displaced, 50 million refugees, 50 million dead in World War II. But the ratios have become even more acute now because there really are no battle lines now. And when you consider wars in Iraq, war in Afghanistan, war in Libya, you don't have armies to speak of. You don't have, you have basically guerrilla forces, resistance forces, insurgents, what have you, that are doing the fighting on one side. And many soldiers, going back to what we were just talking about, one of the things that disturbs them the most is they couldn't tell who were civilians and who were fighters. And the lines are very blurred and therefore very disturbing. So this is modern warfare, and we have to come to terms with this. This is what it is. And we have to take some responsibility for the fact that when we start a war, we not only don't know what's going to happen, but one thing we do know is going to happen is a lot of civilians are going to be hurt.
Let's go back to what you said a moment ago, that these bombings on civilians were supposed to demoralize them. But you raise a very important question in your book, namely, what does the morale of the people even mean, or what does it matter in an authoritarian country?
Right. Yeah, I think it was it was even called terror bombing at the time, and it was meant to strike terror in the society at large. I don't think that there was an analysis by anybody at the time that drew a line between this terror bombing and a change of heart in Hitler's bunker or Tojo's bunker. I mean, there were very few opportunities for people to express their dismay at the Allied bombing, the napalming, firebombing of Dresden and Hamburg and so on. I think that Roosevelt, this is Franklin Roosevelt, of course, and Churchill were just grasping at straws. They wanted to end the war as quickly as possible, again, favoring their own soldiers' lives over the civilians of the enemy population. This is a very old habit of world leaders, and this is just another manifestation of that. But I think that they were trying also to destroy industry, destroy armament manufacturers, railroads and so on. It was a carpet bombing. It was a very blanket kind of approach to destruction. And this also occurred in Korea. North Korea was basically leveled by the U.S. Air Force. Much of South Korea, South Vietnam was leveled, as indeed the industrial parts of North Vietnam were. So this mentality of striking with air power repeatedly, over and over and over again, to the point where you basically destroy the society that you're fighting, was the military doctrine of the United States. It didn't work. It didn't work. That's the important thing to remember. But it also, morally, was savage. It was just an absolutely savage doctrine to carry out in these places.
We're talking to John Tierman about his book, The Deaths of Others, The Fate of Civilians in America's Wars. Now let's talk for a moment about Iraq. I mean, the war, the occupation, the invasion of Iraq is part of our current reality, and yet a lot of people don't understand, and indeed have been shielded from, the scope of the killing in this war. Talk about the numbers of people who've been killed and displaced in Iraq, and what this actually looks like, how it's happened, what it looks like.
Well, it has happened. The two are related, the number of people who are killed, the number of people displaced. In almost all wars, there's a ratio of displaced to dead. And the more violent a country is, the more displaced people you're going to have, and the higher mortality you're going to have. So in Iraq, there was a great deal of killing at the beginning of the war because the United States was using a lot of its air power. Then it became, by late 2003, 2004, a insurgent war. That is, the United States trying to suppress what at first was a Sunni insurgency, and then became, of course, more like a civil war, as the Sunnis and Shia started to fight each other. So by 2006, by the middle of 2006, 3 years after the war started, we have two household surveys that estimate the number of people killed in Iraq as a result of the war, or died as a result of the war, sometimes by what we call structural violence, not being able to get to a hospital or not having medical care, not having clean water, and so on. And by direct violence, and the numbers are between 400 and 600,000. And there was a lot of killing after mid-2006. So overall, there are probably close to a million people who have died as a result of the war. That includes all Iraqis, not just civilians. It might be 700,000, might be 800,000, but it's a lot. It's a lot of people, and there are about 5 million people who have been displaced, about half of them outside Iraq, about half of them inside Iraq. That is, that they felt their neighborhoods were too dangerous. Their homes were under threat. Maybe one of their family members was killed, kidnapped, and so they left because that's the only alternative they had, even though the United States, as an occupying power, had an obligation to provide security to Iraq. We did not do that. So 5 million displaced, this is a UN number, 700,000, 800,000, maybe more dead. That's the numbers that come from these household surveys. That's an awful cost, a human cost of war. Many widows, many orphans, a scar in Iraq that will not heal for generations. This is what we are leaving behind. But, there's no discussion about this. It's hard to get these figures. They're contested by the powerful. They're buried by the newspapers and the news media. We don't want to discuss it because it's too painful to discuss, to think that we went there supposedly with good intentions, and what we have left behind is a smoking ruin with millions of affected people.
If we did discuss it, we might gain an understanding of why people fight back.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things about this debate about how many people have been killed is that, you know, the military and the U.S. government should really be interested in knowing how many people were killed because they could learn something from it. And one of the things they could learn from it is what you just said, is that why was there an insurgency? Well, it was more than one insurgency. It was about, you know, 80 different groups were involved. Why did they fight back? Was it just about Shia Sunni stuff? Was it just about Sunni pride? Was it about Saddam Hussein? You know, I think it was mainly, and there's a lot of evidence for this, it was mainly because they thought, the insurgents thought, they were protecting their communities. Now, we may argue with that, you know, we may not accept that, but that's what they have told, many of them have told researchers who go to, who've interviewed people who've been arrested in Iraq for being insurgents. And so their perception of it is you have an occupier who comes in with all this tremendous firepower, disrupts their lives, searches their houses, you know, abuses in some way their social norms, and they're fighting back.
If I may say so, we would do the same if some foreign army came to try to control our resources.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No question about it. Steve Walt, who's a sort of a well-known academic here at Harvard, and I were talking early in the war, and he said, how would you like it if you walked out of your front door in the morning and there was a guy, you know, in full battle gear and all this intimidating armament that he's carrying, and he's screaming at you in a language you don't understand and pointing the rifle at you and, you know, kicking your, you know, your son and you know, searching your daughter and, you know, doing things that would offend anybody and make anybody, you know, really crazy angry. Well, what would you do? Well, you'd either leave or you'd fight back or you would, you know, sort of cower behind the fence. But it is a natural, it's a natural response to what happened there. But until we understand the scale of violence, this is what we don't want to discuss, until we understand the scale of violence that the United States brought to Iraq, we're not going to be able to understand this resistance.
Let's look forward for a moment. I mean, you've talked about this war machine that seems to have a life of its own, and there are many reasons for it, maintaining the U.S. empire, and we haven't talked about this, but feeding the powerful military contractors who benefit from the war, and just the, if you want to call it warrior instinct, that for many is kind of an addiction. Given the state of the U.S. and of the world right now, what do you see as a future of U.S. wars?
Well, I've predicted this very badly in the past because I thought after Vietnam we weren't going to see any large-scale interventions, and of course we did. It took a while, but there was, starting with Desert Storm and in 1990-91, and one would think that this most recent Iraq war and Afghan war would also dissuade large-scale interventions, and they might. I mean, it might be that that kind of warfare is simply not going to be fought anymore, and what we will fight, what kind of wars we'll fight, are with special forces, so-called, you know, like the SEAL Team 6 types and the Rangers and all these, you know, Green Berets and so on, going in small units to do some operation, and with drones and with air power. So, you know, I think that to some extent is what is on the near-term horizon. That seems to be what we're doing in Somalia and Yemen, or the kind of coalition type thing we did in Libya. You know, the military-industrial complex is very healthy right now. Obama has not scaled back military spending. I think he's doing that mainly for a need for industrial policy. But you know, there's a very, very large, very healthy military budget that is not going to be much touched as far as I can see. So the contractors don't have to worry about starting another war to get their share of the riches. But I think that from the strategic thinkers are going to say, we can't fight a war like Iraq. We can't fight a war like Afghanistan. They don't work anymore. Too many people getting killed, too many of our people. They don't care about the natives. And, you know, we need to we need to apply technology. Technology is always one of the answers in these situations where you're frustrated with how things are going. So you say, oh, well, we need more high tech. We need more precision bombing. We need more intelligence. We need more now drones, you know, so we don't have to risk our pilots and so on. So that looks like the near term. You know, near term, I'm, you know, speaking 5 years out or so. But a lot depends on who's president. A lot depends on what the challenges are. Are there real challenges coming up that people perceive as important? Is your president Barack Obama or Rick Perry? I mean, it does make a difference a little bit on the margins, and that will tell us more than anything that I can predict at the moment.
John Tierman is author of the book The Deaths of Others, The Fate of Civilians in America's Wars. He's principal research scientist and executive director of the Center for International Studies at MIT. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.